Welcome back. Sister Helen Prejean is known around the world for her work advocating for social justice and against capital punishment. She is the author of Dead Man Walking, which was also a hit movie. She's also the author of Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful executions. Her arrival here coincides with the overnight Missouri execution of Jeffrey Ferguson. Capital punishment is a controversial subject with advocates on both sides of the issue. We'll hear from Sister Prejean in just a few minutes. But first, County Prosecuting Attorney Bob McCullough. He supports the death penalty in certain cases. I spoke with him yesterday about that support and asked for his best argument in favor of capital punishment.
I think it's an appropriate punishment, and that's what we're talking about here, is punishment for the particular case, the particular conduct. You have to keep in mind that these cases are not the standard murder case that you come across. No murder is good, but these are particularly horrendous. They're off the charts. As an example, one case I tried was a fellow who is almost 6'6", almost 300 pounds, and he literally butchered his girlfriend and her 2-year-old baby, gutted them, cut the little girl's head off. They're just horrible cases off the charts. And he had a history of violence to go along with that. So we're not talking about cases where there's a barroom brawl or two guys arguing over who should have won the World Series and one shoots the other. Those cases are probably not even murder first degree and certainly not death penalty cases. So it is punishment for those rare, but horrendous cases out there.
I'm curious as to how you determine how one murder is more heinous than another. What are the criteria?
Well, first we determine that it's a murder in the first degree case, that all the elements are there for that. Then the statute is very specific as to what must exist in addition to a murder first degree. There have to be very specific statutory aggravating circumstances. It's a murder for hire, multiple murders, cases that are killing a witness, killing a police officer in the line of duty, doing it while there are other felonies being committed. The kidnapping, Jeffrey Ferguson, for example, was a kidnapping, rape, and murder. And that's what set it apart from other even murder first degree cases. So we follow that statute and examine all the evidence that's available on the aggravating circumstances. And then we also look at any mitigating factors that might exist.
It occurs to me that the victims' families are going through a horrendous period here as well. How does that play into this whole equation?
Well, we try to minimize that as much as possible, but you're really not able to do that. They've suffered through the horrible murder in the first place. Then they've suffered through the reliving that tragedy in a trial, and then the initial appeals, and then over the next 15 to 20, 25 years, every time the case comes up, they have to relive that tragedy, and it takes its toll on people. These are you could imagine the loss that is there, and then have to be reminded of it. Not that you ever forget about it, but to have it dragged up in a public manner for the next 20 years is just that's torture. That's cruel and unusual punishment inflicted upon the victims and the survivors, and that's just wrong.
There are some who might suggest it's cruel and unusual punishment on the criminal himself or herself, particularly during the final stages in a death penalty situation, in which they are waiting through the various stays and legal maneuvers that typically go along at this part of the process.
Well, that's really not much of an argument, Don, because that is of their doing. It's not us delaying for 25 years. It's not the state delaying the process for 25 years. It's the defendant, the defendant's attorneys and supporters who are filing appeal after appeal and writ after writ, knowing full well that they're meritless appeals.
Have there been cases where people have been executed who were later proven to be innocent?
No. There are claims out there of that by anti-death penalty people, but there's certainly in the era of the modern era of the death penalty, which is since about the mid-70s when it was reinstated and approved by the Supreme Court, there has not been. There have been cases certainly where people were sentenced to death and in prison awaiting the appellate process, who were later determined to be actually innocent. Those are few and far between, fortunately, and one is too many, but certainly no documented cases of an innocent person actually having been executed.
Has your opinion of the death penalty evolved or changed over the years since your early days as a prosecutor or even before?
No. No, it hasn't. I follow the same process and procedure, and the good news is that we follow that process fewer times now because there are fewer murders. There are less than half the number of murders in this country today, and certainly in St. Louis County and in Missouri. There are fewer than half than there were 20 years ago, and that's a good thing. And so an incredibly small number of the murders total are potential death penalty cases, and those have dropped, I think, even more than murder in general. You know, the last time, if you look at the evening news, you think we live in a combat zone in a war-torn country, but the reality is the last time that the crime rate in the country and in St. Louis County and city and the state of Missouri was as low as it is today was 1968. It's never been this low. Not since 1968. So it's a very safe and reduced crime over the years. And as I said, that's a good thing, but you would never get that from watching the evening news.
They do things a little bit differently in other countries. I notice Egypt, they've just sentenced 529 people to death because they're members of a rival political organization.
Correct. And you know, that's another invalid argument that I think death penalty opponents make when they compare us to North Korea, they compare us to Egypt, they compare us to Saudi Arabia. You know, we don't take rape victims and put them in a stadium and stone them to death because they were victims of rape. You know, when we do that, then you can compare us to Saudi Arabia and other countries. You know, but until then, that's just not a valid comparison.
But what they do criticize is the fact there seems to be a disparity, a racial disparity, in the number of the people that we execute, more blacks than whites, for instance.
Well, actually, we don't. We don't execute. Most of the people under a sentence of death in this country are white. And most of the executions that are carried out, the defendant is white. The comparison they make is, again, an invalid comparison. You compare what they're comparing are the number of blacks on death row or under a sentence of death to the general population, and it's out of proportion there. But the valid comparison is compare the number of blacks under a sentence of death to the number of murders committed by black men, and it's almost an exact proportion. It's about 40 to 45%. The question they should be asking is, why are so many young black men committing murders, and why are so many young black men the victims of murders? That's the question they don't want to ask. So they make invalid comparisons. And one I use all the time is if you follow that logic, then our system is more sexist than it is racist, because males comprise about 49% of the general population, but they comprise 99% of the death row inmates. But when you compare the number of murders committed in this country, about 99% are committed by males. So it's not surprising that 99% of the people on death row are males. That's the same logic. You know, you have to compare the right sets, and they don't do that on the other side of this argument.
Now to Sister Helen Prejean. She is in town for two events tomorrow at Southwestern Illinois College in Belleville, where she will be lecturing on the death penalty. I spoke to her late this morning, and we began with Missouri's overnight execution of Jeffrey Ferguson.
Missouri is one of the states that does a lot of killing. The Supreme Court gave out a guideline that death penalty is supposed to be reserved for the worst of the worst. And nobody really knows what that means, because when anyone that we love is killed, that's the worst of the worst, because the universe has been lost. Missouri is one of those states, along with my state and the 10 former slave states, that do close to 75% of all the executions. So first of all, you just have to look at the question of why is this? Why are some states carrying it out like Missouri does, and others, even if they have it on the books, they don't carry it out? And I think more and more what it's pointing to after 30 years of practice on this is that the sign in front of the Supreme Court, equal justice under law, people don't know how to apply it, and it's left up to individuals. It's left up to prosecutors. And we see how it pans out. We know that 8 out of every 10 people executed or on death row are there for killing white people, where when we kill people of color, there doesn't seem to be the same outrage or the pressing for ultimate justice. And so I don't, it's broken. We can't do it. We can't play God in it.
Well, prosecutors here seem to think it's fairly well spelled out as to what constitutes a heinous crime and that they are simply following the state guidelines.
Yeah, and look at the guidelines. I know them pretty well in the states. Cruel, heinous, that's a bunch of adjectives hooked on to. But if a black kid in the neighborhood gets killed, somehow we never feel it's cruel or heinous. If a policeman gets killed, well, that's a death penalty, but not if a fireman gets killed. When we go to do our statutes, we have to delineate. Law always means you're going to delineate. And then it's up to the discretion of a prosecutor to decide.
Well, Sister Prejean, you've been at this for a long time now, and you've had a lot of notoriety, an Academy Award-winning movie following your book. Why do you think things have remained fairly stable or static, if you will, over the course of these last 30 years?
You know what, Don? I don't think they are static. I mean, if you look, this year is the lowest support for the death penalty we've seen since 1957. It registers that 60% of the American public say they're for the death penalty, and that's on what we call the up-down question. Are you for the death penalty for this kind of crime? When people are offered the alternative of life without parole, it drops below 50%. And so in the last 7 years, we've had 7 states that have ended the death penalty, and I was just in 2 states, New Hampshire and Delaware, that are getting ready to end it. There's been a real shift not only in the number of states ending it, but the number of executions, the number of death penalties sought. It's been a drastic drop in the practice of the death penalty, and I think we're on our way for it to be on its way out.
There are a lot of people out there who will cite the Bible as a reason for following the death penalty route, and that is the famous eye for an eye.
Yes, it's probably the most quoted line.
Right, of course.
And the most misunderstood. Jesus said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you. And about the Bible quote, I mean, this biblical quarterback, and you toss me your quote, and I'm going to toss you my quote. It's the most selective thing you can do. There were 37 different crimes in the Old Testament for which you could get the death penalty. I mean, you can get the death penalty for not respecting the Sabbath or adultery. But people go for the murder and say, well, this is God's word. Well, what about adultery? Do we want to kill people for adultery? Well, we're more civilized than that now today. And we're very biblically illiterate in our country. 10% of people have identified Joan of Arc as Noah's wife. Now, I mean, look at that. Noah's wife. You know, Noah, the guy with the ark, Joan of Arc. So the selective Bible quoting has gone on forever. We did it for slavery. We did it for why women couldn't vote. Look what Eve did in the garden. She caused all this mess and the fall of into sin, and we can't trust women to vote. You got to really know the Bible, the context in which it was written, and what the spiritual message of it is. And it all moves toward compassion and life. And when you come to Jesus, how can you quote or look at the life of Jesus, that he was executed by the Romans and his last words were forgive them because they don't realize what they're doing, which was about the most compassionate thing you could say about the people who are killing you. So that, I mean, I get it. I totally get it. In fact, when I talk to audiences around the United States, I can have them in chorus say, now give me that Bible quote of why, and they all can say in chorus, an eye for an eye.
Maybe the new movie Noah will straighten out people with regard to Joan of Arc and Noah and the Ark. I'm not sure that it will, but it just might. You know, you have an international reputation, and I'm curious as to what your thoughts are about the recent news that Egypt has condemned 529 men, I'm sure they're all men, to death because they belong to the wrong political party. I'm sure you've looked at that.
Yes, I have. And I stand with Amnesty International and Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We cannot entrust over to government that kind of decision-making to decide whether any human being lives or dies. And there's a good example, so we can do it for political reasons. If you ever go to Malaysia, there's a big sign in the airport, you get the death penalty for drugs. You can never turn over to governments that kind of absolute authority over life, because you're going to find all manner of ways that governments will find why they feel they need to kill people. In Kenya, you could be stoned for having a baby out of wedlock. We got to take death. Death is not our prerequisite. It's not our prerogative to decide which human beings live and die. Punish, we got prisons, okay, but to decide life or death, and there's an example of how a government can say you're in the wrong political party, so you're going to get death.
Well, I suppose it could be argued, given the way punishment is administered in other countries, that we probably stack up fairly well.
Until you look at 194 nations in the world and see the vast majority no longer have the death penalty, that people more and more are understanding about human rights, that Article 3, Article 5 of the Universal Declaration, that people have a right to life and not to be subjected to cruel and degrading punishment or torture. And that when you look and see of the top five countries that do executions, we're in league with China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and what kind of company is that? I mean, what kind of standards of human rights do these countries have? We don't need to do the death penalty anymore. We need to take it off the table where death is not in the arbitration of deciding about how to punish criminals.
You know, our time is winding down, but again, I'd like to get your impression of what role the relatively new Pope might play in this kind of debate. Do you have any sense that he could be a player in convincing people around the world that the death penalty is something that should be abolished?
Yeah, he's so much on the side of poor people and for the gospel of justice that absolutely. I see him with Pope John Paul as a 1-2 Pope punch, if we might call it that, because it was Pope John Paul in St. Louis in 99, who was the first one who put the death penalty in with other pro-life issues. And when he was in St. Louis in 99, he said, no, to the usual things Catholics hear when you hear pro-life, abortion, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, but no to the death penalty, Pope John Paul said, because it's cruel and unnecessary, because we have a way to defend ourselves, and even those among us who have done a terrible crime have a dignity that must not be taken from them. And so surely Pope Francis, who within 2 weeks of being Pope is in a prison washing prisoners' feet, what does that say? So if you can wash a prisoner's feet, what about how you feel then about taking a prisoner's life? And so I see Pope Francis as a great gift to all of us.
Sister Helen Prejean has two presentations at Southwestern Illinois College tomorrow at 2 and 7 p.m. We have details on our website. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with journalist Amy Goodwin about her career trying to give voice to those who are often unheard. And we'll talk about a new film being screened at the Missouri History Museum tomorrow night called Waking in Oak Creek. It's about the 2012 hate crime killings at the Sick Temple of Wisconsin. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.